This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome everybody to what should be one of our most stimulating sessions. This is a monthly meeting of the Winston Lord Roundtable on Asia, the Rule of Law, and U.S. Foreign Policy. And we have a wonderful topic and a marvelous speaker. The topic, I think everyone who's in this audience knows, is history, and history and its contemporary today's implications. Front page story in the New York Times talks about the sixth plenary session of the 19th Chinese Communist Party Central Committee that convened today in Beijing and be going for the next few days, and the widely anticipated new third resolution in the party's 100-year history that will define the place of the party for the future. This makes me recall many aphorisms from the Soviet experience as well as the Chinese. One Soviet cynic, having observed some of these historical exercises, liked to say the Soviet posture was, the present is wonderful, the future is marvelous, only the past is uncertain. And that focused on the importance of controlling history. Better known to people today is George Orwell's famous maxim that who controls the present controls the past, and who controls the past controls the future. And that's what the struggle is on in China. I can't think of anybody I'd rather discuss this with than Professor Jeremy Barmay. He and I have had some cooperation in recent years, and what's impressed me was his immense mastery of Chinese culture and language and history, but also his huge concern for contemporary human rights in China and the fate of some people, including distinguished law professors whom I revere. It's a wonderful thing to be able to exchange ideas with Jeremy. You all know his background, and he was quoted first one in today's Times story by Chris Buckley, and appropriately so. So we're honored to have Jeremy with us. He's in his quiet nest in New Zealand, and available now. I'm going to ask him to talk for 15 or 20 minutes. I'll make a few comments and then we'll open the floor to members of our distinguished audience. I'm quite excited. I looked at the participant list and it's a wonderful variety of talented, knowledgeable people. So Jeremy, as they say in the Ministry of Public Security in Beijing, shoot.
Jerry, thank you so much. I'd very much like to thank Jerry Cohen today and Kathy Huang for helping organize, but also Jerry's kind invitation. Our exchanges in recent years have been much to do with contemporary Chinese human rights issues and law, and in particular, the fate of Professor Xu Ranrun, formerly of Tsinghua University. Now, Professor Xu Ranrun is one of the people who has in his writings over the last 5 or 6 years, which are famously critical of the Xi Jinping era, he has frequently referred to the very kernel of my own discussion today. And he refers to this period of Chinese modernization that began not with Deng Xiaoping, not with Mao Zedong, but rather began in the Qing dynasty in the 1860s, in a period that is known to historians as the Tongzhi Restoration, the restoration of the Tongzhi Reign period. And what's interesting for me today is that I last addressed your august group, the council, 1 year ago at the invitation of Julian Gerwitz, who has, as you know, gone on to better or worse things, depending on how you see these matters. But Julian asked me to address the issue of Chinese technical innovation and renewal. I addressed in particular the question of what's called rencai, human talent in Chinese. Deng Xiaoping was famous for being a man who helped renew the educational revolution and scientific transformation of the Chinese world in the 1970s. When he came back into power, the most common quote at the time in 77 was Mao Zedong saying, Deng Xiaoping regards us as a rencai, rencai nande, he's a true human talent, and such talent is hard to find. This drags me immediately back, not to last year's topic, but to the 1870s. The restoration of the Qing dynasty was a restoration carried out following a major series of national catastrophes, war internationally with the French and the British, but also an internal rebellion by the Taiping armies that threatened to overthrow the ruling Qing dynasty. The restoration is called Zhongxing in Chinese, is a type of dynastic activity or a period in a dynastic evolution in which one attempts to revive the fate of the dynasty, the fortunes of the dynasty, by in particular reordering the nation on the basis of finding and appointing to power the best rencai talents available. Rencai is a key word in the 1860s and 70s restoration. It's about empowering a morally superior, but also technically competent bureaucracy to carry out renewal and renovation. The 1860s and 70s see that renovation in terms of economic transformation, a self-strengthening movement aimed at creating a modern Chinese military force, a protection of the borderlands, a crushing of corruption among bureaucrats, as well as the crushing of rebellion, in particular in the 1870s in Xinjiang. The 1860s is regarding the beginning of China's modernizing movement to become a global recognized country. And it's this movement that was continued by Deng and the others in the 1970s, that reform period was in fact a renewal of that push to reform and transform the country. In fact, the word gaige, reform, is a Qing dynasty term as well. It was used in the restoration of the 1870s. Now, my interest in restoration today is one inspired by more recent events. In 1997, Zhang Zemin, in a poem, used the word zhongxing, which means literally in the midst of something to carry out a revival, so restoration or midterm revival. And he said in his poem that we are gathered here in Beijing, he was celebrating the National People's Congress convocation, we're gathered in Peking to discuss zhongxing shi, matters to do with revival and renewal. In doing so, zhongxing, he was also making a reference to the slogan, the revival of the Chinese race, Zhonghua Minzu Wei Da De Fuxing Zhongxing, because Zhang Zemin was the man who revived this slogan back in the 1970s and was saying, in fact, that our efforts after 1989 are part and parcel of the renewal of the Communist Party, its morality, its vision of the world, its economic and political enterprise. We are carrying out a renovation, a restoration of the true path of our reforms. Now, I won't go into further detail. It's too much to say about the revival of elements of the imperial era, dynastic language, how this language was used by the Maoists from the 1930s onwards. But put simply, the Jiang Zemin era saw the laying out of the groundwork of what we now are seeing coming to a new kind of fruition under Xi Jinping. That is not only a restoration and a revival of the Chinese race, but also a resolution, according to the debates of the last 30 years, of the national ethnic policies. And as we know, they've moved in a direction quite different from the 1990s. They've led to the emphasis on what is called the China story, the particular narrative of the Chinese nation. The China story was, in fact, first articulated most clearly in 2007 by then Ambassador Fu Ying when she was in England. And the China story was taken up by Xi Jinping's advisors in 2012. In fact, many elements, the China dream, revival of the Chinese nation, the whole renewal of China, its anti-corruption campaign. These things all have their roots in this period in the 1990s. And that's why I would just emphasize that what Xi Jinping and his colleagues are doing is a continuation of quite a long process, an evolution of ideas and beliefs as well as policies, which are particularly focused on rensai, human talent. Now, it's the selection of a talent, and Xi Jinping just recently gave two speeches on this subject. He's spoken frequently about it, is a talent that is technically competent, as they used to say in Maoist China, zhuan, as well as being hong, red, or politically reliable. It's a type of talent that, according to the Xi Jinping and the Communist Party worldview, is deeply moral, even though we may regard the Chinese Communist moral universe as being highly suspect because of its attitude towards minority rights, to vulnerable groups in the society, to ethnic rights, and so on and so forth. But the mainstream communist viewpoint, it is a morality that is based on the forward movement of history. And this is where Xi Jinping himself, as I mean, Chris Buckley puts it very well, as does his article, he sees himself as the summation of Chinese evolution and Chinese history. In fact, in his way he's articulated Chinese historical progress and its role, the role of China globally, is in a way to articulate the belief, and this is based on a Leninist, originally Leninist view, that the Communist Party of China is literally the end point of Chinese history. That is, it's last political evolution before the realization of a higher stage of social development. So this this sounds very very much like an Armageddon view of things, but if you read Xi Jinping's speeches, if you pay attention to the propaganda of the communists in particular, since the Olympic period, 2007 and 2008, this is the view that's articulated, in particular in regard to the realization of China's what's called the second centenary, the centenary of the founding of the People's Republic, which will be celebrated in 2049, which will see China not only as what they call a modernized socialist wealthy power, but also, in fact, a global power, if not the preeminent global power. Within the debates and discussions about restoration, reviving the fates of a failing bureaucracy, and Xi Jinping himself, as I've written, I've sent out a link to all of you regarding the whole issue of restoration and the period of the counter-reforms of 1989 to 1992. Xi Jinping and his colleagues felt that China in the late years of the Hu Jintao era, from 2006 or 7 to 2012, was facing moral collapse as a political entity. And when Xi Jinping comes into power, it's part of not only a restoration in terms of reviving the moral dimension of the cardocracy and dealing with corruption, but it's also a matter of saving the party from further decline and the undermining of its political authority and rights. And in fact, the third party decision that will be passed in the next couple of days, it's already been long discussed, will in one way or other posit the type of role that Xi Jinping has played in contemporary Chinese history. In the old Cultural Revolution era, the term used to describe Chairman Mao's unique role was to say that Chairman Mao, by launching the Cultural Revolution, had wan jiu le gemin, he had saved the revolution from reactionary revisionism, and wan jiu le dan, saved the party from collapse through corruption. Now, Xi Jinping himself, I have no doubt, sees himself as playing a similar role, to have saved the Chinese revolutionary tradition by carrying out the policies that he has over the last number of years, which, as I said, all have a long-term origin. And he believes that he is, and his colleagues, all the generation of the Cultural Revolution era, that they are the salvation of the Chinese revolution. And therefore, they have in their activities a dimension that is messianic, that is transformative, and they believe that is of global significance, not only for China, but for the world itself. If you're familiar with the leading Tsinghua University pro-communist thinker, what I call one of the Maoist Holocaust deniers, Wang Hui, a leading academic who's much thought of in places like New York University, at Harvard and elsewhere, he wrote an article last year at great length praising the revolutionary personality It's about Lenin, it commemorates Lenin's centenary, but the article, which has been published in English by my friend David Owenby in Reading the China Dream, it's actually about the Maoist Xi Jinping personality. That is the unique revolutionary personality. And Wang Hui's article is like an article de clé. You can read it as being an interpretation of the Xi Jinping role in China's destiny. Anyway, all of this, just a few quick comments about all of this. All of this leads also to back to the restoration era of the 1860s and 70s, one of the key issues of which was that of succession. Because the restoration movement of the 1860s and 70s, the self-strengthening of China's army, the revival of the bureaucracy, which were very successful for some decades, all began to falter because the ruling emperor, the Tongzhi emperor, died in 1874. And thereafter, the Qing dynasty suffered until its final collapse in 1912 from a series of succession crises. They had not been able to resolve or find the right type of successor to the young emperor. He was said to have died from syphilis, but nonetheless, various other cognate relatives were brought in to play the role of emperor, and lots of political crisis occurred around all of that. But Xi Jinping himself has returned China, not only to a period of restoration in a very new context, a continuation of this modernizing effort that began in the 1860s and 70s, but he's also returned China to one of its traditional dilemmas, and that is the dilemma of succession. And as you all know, the third party historical decision that will be passed this week, as well as the 20th Party Congress that will be convened next year, will all confront the nation once more with the succession crisis that has been at the heart of Communist Party politics since Mao Zedong came to power in 1936. In that period, as you know, this, what is it now, 80, 90 years, there's only been one peaceful transfer of power that happened in 2003 when Hu Jintao took over the mantle from Jiang Zemin. Xi Jinping got into power as a result of a political purge. Although it's done up as being an anti-corruption campaign against Bo Xilai, it was in fact a political struggle. And so Xi Jinping has returned the nation to the same type of crisis it's had in the past. One is relying on a supposedly morally superior cohort of people through their enlightened political views and activities who are capable of forswearing corruption, maintaining probity, and carrying out an idealistic utopian type of revolutionary enterprise into the future. It's never worked in the past in China from the Maoist period onwards. And also he's thrown China into the quandary of how to deal with the succession crisis to himself. As he will, as you know, he's already placed himself as the new grand leader, the heliotropic type of leader in China, the third great leader since the 1930s. He therefore can't easily be unseated. Meanwhile, we know for certain that others who would like to succeed him or push him aside will inevitably try to idolize him even further so that he can be more of a dead than a living ancestor. This will be the task that those who would succeed him, who are active now and must be concerned with the fate of the nation in the years to come, will have to deal with. As you can see, I'm beginning to ramble about things. So I should really stop here and open the floor to discussion with Jerry taking the lead.
Well, that was a terrific beginning, and it opens now the floor to many questions. One I've always had is, how great a Confucian is Xi Jinping? He seemed an unlikely sponsor of a revival of Confucianism, yet he seemed to be exploiting it as a kind of a supplement to or replacement of lack of faith in communism that many people have come to share. And I wondered, Confucianism, of course, features Shao, filial piety, respect for the parents, the wisdom of the father. And Xi Jinping has been praising his father, Xi Zhongxun, in many respects, establishing a museum here or there, and sometimes implying that maybe his father deserves more praise than Deng Xiaoping. And yet what Xi Jinping is doing is a major rejection of the distillation of his father's experience and wisdom. Because as you know, when the father came back after 16 years of Maoist exile to Beijing and began to have a position of authority again, he asserted we should allow for differences of opinion in the party, not only among the masses, but among the elite. So, Bu Tong Yi Jian, we must have differences of opinion if the party is ever to achieve its goal. So, do you have any comments on this? It makes me doubt how great a Confucianist is Xi Jinping.
Well, I mean, Xi Jinping, like his predecessors, is a Confucian by convenience. I mean, the whole Confucian revival began in the mid-1980s, and the Peng Chung, Ji Pengfei, and others, inspired much by the Singaporean model. It's a Confucianism that in the field of history is state Confucianism. That is this facade of human virtue, talent, equality, respect for hierarchy, respect for ancestors, and all of that type of stuff that is layered over a hardline legalist or controlling approach to politics, hierarchy, and power. It's been state Confucianism developed in the first century AD, and it's always been a mixture of morality with extreme hypocrisy. And Xi Jinping and the others they cleave to Confucian terms when he talks about education in China, the training of a moral cadre, and so on and so forth. He is referring to that type of state Confucianism. Behind it lies the steady beating heart of Stalinism. Just as, in fact, just a historical point, the very first party leader who articulated clearly a combination of Stalinist modes of thinking with Confucian values was Liu Shaoqi, who in 1939 gave a series of lectures later published as How to Be a Good Communist. And he combined Confucian ideas, quotes from Mencius, with Stalinism. And that is still, if anyone's interested in the basic worldview of Xi Jinping, it's very useful to read those lectures. They're available in English and in Chinese, and they are still one of the best guides. They're like a catechism for the understanding of Xi Jinping thought. So at the very heart of the communist enterprise in China has been this melding of traditional ideas, dynastic habits, with Stalinist modes of political activity. And Xi Jinping is a leader who continues in that tradition, and he uses a lot of Confucian style language. Nothing he has done really reflects it in reality, except for, as I said, crude state Confucianism. Xu Ranwen himself, the professor, dissenting professor of Tsinghua, he is an acolyte of one of China's great 20th century Confucians, Liang Shuming, known as The Last Confucian, a very famous book by that title by Guy Alito. And Liang Shuming fell out with Mao in 1953 because Liang Shuming stood up for the traditional family, for the countryside, for the rights of farmers, and Mao had him purged. So China's put an end to real Confucian activism in its polity in 1953, and it's never revived, despite what anyone might say, despite all the theoretical goings on of academics in Chinese academia. Du Weiming, the famous Harvard professor, now a professor at Peking University with a large research center and a grant, all of it's hypocrisy. None of it means anything. In terms of just the state Confucian habits of mind, however, Xi Jinping and his colleagues, and this is particularly evident since the Jiang Zemin era, do refer back constantly to the Yan'an period, to the founding leaders, the Liu Shaoqi's, to Mao and to Deng Xiaoping, to draw inspiration, but also to validate their policies and ideas. Now, this is a form of quotational politics that is central. The use of precedent, the use of quotation, the use of one's ancestors. If one's ancestors can't serve the living, then what's the use of them, basically? And Xi Jinping is extremely good at pursuing this type of approach to Chinese culture and politics. Just before October the 1st this year, she and his colleagues announced that there were 43 national spirits, Jingshen. These are the formally enthroned elements of Chinese spiritual culture that are now recognized as central to the Chinese national character. And of the 43, quite a few of them relate to values and ideas that have Confucian echoes, but in reality, they're all just, it's just all window dressing. This is about, you know, practical power and about how to use and deploy culture and history to serve your own purposes. I think, if anything, our friends in America are very familiar with this type of behavior, because after all, it's something rather central to the way that America has been dealing with its own legacy from the 1860s in the last few years. And the debates about culture, identity, the constitution, interpretations, and so on and so forth. So this is very familiar territory to anybody in the American Union.
I'm very glad you mentioned Stalinism and the everlasting questions of succession. I've been saying for some years that given what Xi Jinping is doing, everyone in China should see the movie called The Death of Stalin. And although it purports to be a comedy, people who see it may think what Xi Jinping is setting China up for is a comedy of errors, and the joke may be on them, because you wonder what will happen, because he will not last forever, whatever the duration of his rule. And what will that mean? How will succession be handled? And I think he is a Stalinist in the way he rules. Stalin, people often forget, was a great believer in rule by law. Stalin, at the height of the purges in 1937, had the effrontery to say, "We need the law more than ever." And he meant it in the Leninist sense as an instrument of repressive government, to guarantee that there would be uniform party rule throughout a vast country. So I'm wondering, what thoughts does this inspire in you?
Well, it's funny you should mention, well, Stalin inevitably leads us back to that period, and you should mention the Great Purge. The Great Purge, as you know, was accompanied by the Moscow Show Trials. And the Moscow Show Trials are incredibly significant for China, because one of the leading founders of the Chinese Secret Service and one of the architects of the Yan'an rectification movement, which Xi Jinping refers to frequently, a man by the name of Kang Sheng, he was present at the Moscow State Trials. He was invited by Voshinsky to be an auditor at the trials. And when he got back to China in the late 30s and became Mao's chief advisor on security matters, he suggested that the type of purge that China carry out should follow that of the Moscow example. However, Mao said, yes, we should do that, but we shouldn't kill as many people. We must, after all, you never know when we might need them again. So he said the big caveat in China was, don't kill any of your leading comrades unless you really have to. Keep them around. Stalin's big mistake was to kill too many competent people, whether it be in the military or whether it be in the civilian bureaucracy. So that's an element of the Chinese leadership that has continued to this. As we know, Bo Xilai was not executed, though his crimes would have called for him to be executed. And maybe Sun Zhonghua won't be, or what's his name? Fu Zhenhua and Sun Lijun, who've recently just been purged. But yes, the Stalinist mode of excessive use of law to rule, not the rule of law, but rule by law, use laws to rule, as you said, these are central to China's modern experience. As you know, you're in China when the illegal reforms began following the third plenary session in 1978. And one of the people who was brought back to carry out legal reform, Peng Zhen, was one of the greatest murderers under the Communist Party's leadership in the 1950s. So many of us found the concept of Chinese legal reform being carried out by one of the greatest mass murderers in the party's history to be more than a little ironic.
I tried to meet Peng of course, when I was living in Beijing, 79, 80, 81, but he wouldn't do it, even though he was in charge of the development of the...
Well, Jerry, how he would have been, what could he have said to you? I mean, you would have really put him on the spot.
Yeah, I don't know, but I regretted that I missed that opportunity. But tell me about Deng Xiaoping. You see, he was a brilliant man. He certainly did a lot for China's outreach to the world, its foreign policy, its economic development. And yet I feel people too often forget he was a Stalinist at heart. He presided as party secretary general over the anti-rightist movement that suppressed hundreds of thousands of intellectuals, 1957-58. And later, 20 years later, he actually had to participate and lead their rehabilitation, even if it was posthumous in the case of some of them. But I think Deng was always at heart, and he showed that on, of course, June 4th, 1989, a Stalinist when it came to internal political development. So, but I'd love to hear your views, because that's very much now up for reconsideration this week at the party.
Well, I don't know what the new document will say, but as you said, Deng Xiaoping was a truly extraordinary figure that he managed to oversee with, it must be pointed out, a group of comrades, because he did it, he was only part of a collective. He was a very powerful and clever operative himself, but many of the ideas that he used were garnered from his colleagues, whether Chen Yun or Peng Zhen or Li Xianyan or others. So it was a collective move in the late 70s to save the party from itself, really. But Deng and his colleagues, that they managed a transition after the famous coup of October 76, a transition out of the Cultural Revolution to divest Maoist interests and to launch the type of economic reforms that actually had been mooted in the early 1950s. They returned to the 50s to launch reforms that were first mooted then, but then put on hold by Mao and Liu Shaoqi, without incredible bloodshed, is one of the great achievements of modern Chinese history. There's no doubt about it. And a brilliant man and a brilliant figure. However, as you say, a Stalinist and a Maoist through and through, a pragmatic man when he did rehabilitate the intellectuals and the intellectual movement. The purge of intellectuals in 57 was not merely of a pack of academics. It was of the whole legal establishment. It was the whole media establishment of Republican China. It was of the whole scientific community. It was a purge of 550,000 of the leading minds in industry, in business, in academia, and in every area of civilian government. So many people seem to think that it was mostly just about academics. It wasn't. It was a massive move to purge the country of the Republic of China. And it was incredibly effective. And even though Deng Xiaoping and his colleagues partially rehabilitated and brought back purged people in 1978, began in the early 70s, 78 to 1981, they remained aligned that there were six people who should never be rehabilitated. And those six people are used to this day. If you read the latest concise history of the Communist Party published earlier this year, they're still mentioned. Those six people are used to justify the destruction of those 550,000 people and the destruction of the institutions of the Republic of China. So one should remember that the groundwork for Xi Jinping's purge of universities starting in 2011-12, even before he got into power, the purge of rights lawyers and activists today, the purge of intellectual and cultural life in China that's still unfolding, the origins of that, of course, lie in the early 50s and mid 50s, but they lie in particular in the fateful decisions made at the third plenum in 1978, which are overshadowed by everybody's obsession with the economic reforms and ignoring the failure to carry out substantive reforms in terms of public opinion, media oversight, intellectual independence, and so on and so forth. All of these things that were debated in the early 1950s and crushed. To ignore that aspect of things means that most people have been a bit taken aback by Xi Jinping's policies. I've not been taken aback at all. I was aware of exactly what Deng and his colleagues had done. They laid the basis for the autocracy of Xi Jinping today. And the new document may well, we'll see how they do, whether they demote Deng or not. Xi Jinping has already given us a very clear hint. When he got into power in January 2013, he said very clearly that under no circumstances should we use the second 30 years, i.e. the reform period from 78 to 2008, it's called the Diara Sanshenyan, should we use the second 30 years to negate the first 30 years, the Diga Sanshenyan, Qian Sanshenyan, from 48, 49 to 1978. So his policy has been throughout that we must reconcile the whole era of 49 to 76 with that of 78 to 2008. And this has been at the core, in fact, it was the core of Deng Xiaoping's own concerns. Although they negated the Cultural Revolution in 1981, Deng and his colleagues returned to the early 50s and began to reconsider the policies of that era to find inspiration for their own policies. Just as Xi Jinping has returned to the 1950s and taken a different line and found inspiration for controlling industry, education, political life and the media in a very different way from Deng. But in fact, they're very similar in many other ways.
Your references to the 1978 period when decisions were made how to recover from the Cultural Revolution make me recall the speculation that some of us engaged in about what would this mean for the legal system. My wonderful first formal student, Victor Lee, published a book just before the 78 period. It was called Law Without Lawyers. The idea was maybe China was different. Maybe China didn't need Western legal system. Maybe it didn't need a Soviet style Western legal system. Maybe it could do things without lawyers, the legal profession, without formal institutions. But Deng Xiaoping didn't read that book. And when we saw what was going to happen, it seemed to be an evident reassertion of the Soviet legal system that Mao had introduced and yet demolished. And it was encouraging to me in the sense it meant my study of formal legal institutions in the Soviet Union and China would not be irrelevant. But I confess it was a sense of disappointment. I did hope China would do something distinctive, something really unusual. And of course, that didn't happen because Deng really proved himself to be a Stalinist. But he had the wit to say you had to engraft upon the reasserted Soviet system a lot of novel features that would be attractive to Western business and foreign countries. And he remembered what Lenin had said in the early period of the Soviet Union about why they needed law so the British and French capitalists would invest in Soviet Russia.
Yeah.
So this is, it's interesting to see how Xi Jinping is building on that today.
Well, absolutely. I think, again, it's too easy. And it was at the time as you probably know, I've been rather independently critical of the reforms and where China would go politically from 1979. I've never been a great believer in massive socio-political transformation, a great believer in economic change, but very dubious about, well, from the arrest of Wei Jingsheng in March 1979, I've been a doubter. I must say, when he was arrested for that famous poster that I read on the democracy wall in Beijing titled, "Do we want democracy or do we want a new autocrat?" And he was arrested 2 weeks later. It was a major moment in my own life, not to mention that of Wei Jingsheng's. But Deng Xiaoping and the others in discussing the second party history decision that was published in 1981, Deng Xiaoping gave many, many talks. They're all available. I read them at the time and they're all available now in English as well. And among the many things he said, we must remember that Chairman Mao's leadership from 1949 to 1957 was absolutely correct in every respect. Now, this is something that many people overlook. So By saying that, he was not only salvaging Mao for use today, but also affirming the role that he and his colleagues had in the creation of the early socialist system, the creation of the Chinese constitution, and the creation of their modern Stalin-like legal system. He was affirming that everything we did in those days, for those first 8 years of the People's Republic, was absolutely correct. Now, that is a pretty devastating, if one goes back and looks at that history carefully, it's a pretty devastating thing for him to have said. And it's been too easy for people to ignore that. Xi Jinping himself draws lots of inspiration from the early 1950s, just as much as he does from the Yan'an period, but even perhaps more from the 50s. After all, when we look at his purge of, or his selective corralling of certain tech billionaires today, what he's in fact doing is very familiar to anybody who knows what happened in 1953-54 with the select destruction of the Chinese bourgeoisie and industrial capitalists, which was carried out very much under the guidance of Mao, Peng Zhen, Liu Shaoqi, and others, and eventually led to Mao's radical move to create what was at the time called shared prosperity. Something that Xi Jinping, people act as though this is some new development. This is all stuff from the 1950s. I'm not saying it's just irrelevant and it's just retro. It is has a complete ideological, cultural, as well as historical coherence to it. What he's doing makes complete and utter sense. It, in the past, led to the most disastrous results, but he and his colleagues believe that they will be combining elements of the successful Maoist, well, they believe, successful Maoist transformation of the 49 to 57 period with elements of the Cultural Revolution, with elements of the radical reform move, in particular of the 1990s and 2000s. That is their aim, if you look at their general forecast. And then the aim is, as you know, to create an unparalleled, powerful, global exemplar that is morally, politically, economically, educationally superior to any other country in the world. This is, as it was the aim in the 1950s under Mao and Stalin before him, so it is with Xi Jinping today. I mean, I wouldn't dismiss it. I take it extremely seriously. It's not something that I would vote for myself, but nonetheless, it is something I do take very seriously.
Your mention of Liu Shaoqi a couple of times, as well as other people in the party over time who've been purged, makes me want to ask one final question before we turn it over to our many good participants. And that's about the element of human tragedy. Liu Shaoqi, after all, rotted away to death in prison, just the way many dissidents have subsequently. We have other people I've known and respected and cooperated with over the years who just sort of disappeared now. Not literally, we know they're still around. They haven't disappeared the way some human rights lawyers have. We don't know whether they're still dead or alive, but they've been silenced. They're still in Beijing. And of course, the thing that's so fascinating about our mutual friend, Professor Zhang, is he's not in prison formally, but he's been isolated in such a way and deprived in so many respects that he is living in a kind of social prison. Now, what about so many others? You reminded me, you mentioned my former Harvard colleague, Du Weimin. I haven't thought about him in years. Is he still active as a historian? What's happened? I know what's happened to the law professors, but what's happened to the historians, Western trained, many of whom really taught in the West? Du was an outstanding professor at Harvard and a charming, nice guy, but I haven't heard what's happened to him.
Well, last time Xi Jinping went to Peking University, must have been 2014 or 15, one of the many people who was there to greet him and shake his hand was Du Weimin, who has established a major research center with central government funding. And he is a great advocate of state Confucianism and is doing very nicely, thank you. So many of the Chinese academics who have exchanged with the global environment, the global academic institutions over the last 30 or 40 years, Many of them, I have many colleagues who've learned to be quiet, who have delved into other matters, who are focusing their attentions on more arcane academic pursuits. Some are going along with the new dispensation and talking about global giant Chinese values and so on and so forth. Many have, and not surprisingly to me, because of the weight of the system, the power of the bureaucracy, as well as the nature of academic funding in China, which goes primarily at the moment, not primarily, but which gives a lot of emphasis to research centers devoted to Xi Jinping's thoughts, application to various forms of academic pursuit. Many people have fallen silent, or have just they've grown up knowing how to play the game, and many of them just play the game. Those who dare to speak up, and Xu Dianrun went into open rebellion. He began to write highly critical things of the Xi Jinping era in 2016, but he broke into sort of open rebellion in July 2018, and that was caused by the revision to the Chinese constitution in March 2018 that made it possible for Xi Jinping to have a third term in office. And that's what led him and many of his legal colleagues and friends to, well, they were just, you know, despairing because of this move. Xu Dianrun in particular decided to put his despair into a written form and publish this long critique of Xi Jinping, which I've sent a link to everybody if you're interested in reading what he wrote at that time. Everything he said then still is relevant today. And that was because he said that all of the hopes for China to continue economic and social and political and academic reforms in the hope of realizing the possibility of turning China into a modern country with a proper legal system, with a proper media environment, with suitable forms of oversight and debate and public discussion, a modern society with at least, no matter how riven it might be by different views, a society that was a civil society rather than being a militarized society, the aim of which is to prop up one political party and to carry out the collective aims of that one political organization. Now, that is where China is today. It's, as you know, Xi Jinping's and his colleagues, they bend Chinese tradition to justify their actions as being reflective of Chinese collective aspirations. You know, Chinese people, by their nature, prefer to act collectively rather than individually. They prefer order rather than chaos, and so on and so forth. All these myths about Chinese tradition and history and thought are deployed by the Communist Party to justify its autocratic rule and to justify its own political, cultural, and social aims. All the while, I should just point out, all the while disguising that it is a powerful, highly secretive, and incredibly successful oligopoly, one that is ruled by a number of families who have billions of dollars in assets that are completely hidden from public view and are not accountable in any way whatsoever. I would just end that comment by remarking that you will note that apart from a few children or grandchildren of political party grandees who have somehow offended the Xi Jinping regime, no major member of the real red gentry, the ruling family bureaucracies that have been around for 70 odd years, not one of the leading figures has really gone down except for Bo Xilai in the last 10 years. They, however, I mean, they have stated, I wrote an article some years ago about this, they collectively have said that because we are the children of revolutionary parents and grandparents, we have a red DNA, famous line, we have a red DNA that means that we are above corruption.
That's good. Well, I'd like to continue monopolizing the conversation with you, but I think I have an obligation to let you hear from others. And Audrey, I think we're ready to begin the question period. Do we have a first question?
Yes. So first of all, as a reminder to ask a question, please click on the raise hand icon on your Zoom window. When you are called on, accept the unmute now prompt and proceed with your name and affiliation followed by your question. If you would like to view the roster of registered participants for this meeting, a link will be sent in the Zoom chat. So our first question comes from Ko Yang Tung.
Hi, Hi, thank you very much, Professor Barmei, for your fascinating historical sweep in order to understand China today. Oh, I'm Ko Yang Tang. I'm Jerry Cohen's student. Once a student, always a student. My question is this. You had mentioned that in the CCP's leadership that there has only been one peaceful transition. And if that is so, the continuity of Xi Jinping for eternity may not be a bad thing if you want stability and continuity. And therefore, that may be an argument in favor of keeping him on for 3 and 4 and other terms.
Indeed, Mr. Tang, that is exactly the argument made by Xi Jinping and his colleagues. We in China have a unique opportunity. We don't have this, folderole of this of parliamentary system or an American constitution or this other electoral garbage. We have a perfect, what they call a woe to go, an alpha omega democracy that gives us complete access to public opinion. And we have a leader who has, because of his policies, and of course the party argues that Xi Jinping's policies are absolutely successful in every single regard, no matter what you or I might think to the contrary. And because they're so successful, we just want more of them. In fact, why not forever? As you said, why not forever? Indeed, I don't know if you're aware, but the Chinese party established in the 1990s established a health and longevity project, which is aimed at extending the lives of party leaders of a certain grade and upwards, first to 100 years, and if possible, to 150 years. Now, in light of that, I believe that Xi Jinping and his colleagues hope that at least he'll be, if not the chairperson or chairman, dare say he'll be renamed chairman next year at the 20th Party Congress, not only the leader of China, or at least the de facto leader, the Ominous Guise in the future, up to 2049. So you can see, we can expect him to be around for another 20 or 30 years, if not longer. Indeed, why not just stay with the permanent presidency? After all, your own Donald Trump tried to do that very thing.
Of course, the situation in America now, to some people, would make that theory, that justification, more attractive than ever, because it's obvious to us and to the world we're having trouble getting continuing unified leadership. On the other hand, the long-run costs of the Xi Jinping philosophy and practice may be very great. But let's have the next question, Audrey.
Our next question is from John Holden.
Hi, this is John Holden, formerly of the Yenching Academy at Peking University. Jeremy, we had lunch in Canberra a number of years ago.
We did indeed.
Enjoyed it very much. Good to see you. McLarty Associates is where I hang my hat. You mentioned Kangsheng earlier, and my question has to do with what do we know about the security apparatus and the role it plays in Chinese politics today?
I wish I could ask you. I'm not a specialist in that area. My inklings of what was going to happen after the Olympics actually came from friends in the security apparatus in 2006, 2007, 2008. I was doing a project back then to do with the Olympic era, the life of Beijing around the Olympics. And because of my connections, I was able to have contact with a number of people who were training the security people who were, you know, investing in drone apparatuses and involved in high tech. And I built on my work that I'd done on the Great Firewall of China in the 1990s. So I had some sense of things back then, but that's now 12, 13 years ago. I no longer, because of COVID, of course, I can't go to China. And because of my work on Xu Guangrun and others, I probably won't be able to go to China, nor can I speak to anybody by phone, nor can I really get easy access. So I really don't know. All one would know is that Xi Jinping got into power. And at that time, I was working with my colleagues at the Australian Center on China in the World, which I established with Kevin Rudd's support in 2010. We were working with the Chinese Contemporary Institutes of International Relations, KICA, which is under, as you know, the Ministry of State Security. And shortly after Xi Jinping's rise to power, Kicker was put on lockdown for nearly 6 months. Everybody's mobile phones were confiscated. A secretary to the former deputy head of Kicker was under investigation and arrested for security breaches. And the Kicker leadership was purged. They replaced the then leaders who went on to other tasks with Yuan Peng and these other hardline characters. So that was the only direct contact I had with a good old security type of purge at the time. We do know that something rather delightful has happened recently, as you dare say, aware with the downfall of Sun Li Zhong, who was Xi Jinping's hitman in Hong Kong and elsewhere, himself a figure with a police background and security bona fides. And what's been just, and this is not really an answer to your question at all, but what's been delightful about the Sun Li Zhong fall from grace is that, I don't know if you saw the list of crimes of which he has been accused, published in the People's Daily. It is it's hysterical. It's very funny and delightful. I've translated it all. I want to write something. I've written something about it, but haven't had time to publish it. What is delightful about it is here is one of the key figures in the Chinese security apparatus under Xi Jinping, who has operated under Xi Jinping for 9 years, and yet he has amassed large amounts of money, secretive files, and engaged in numerous inappropriate political activities, including building up a power base, presumably to carry out a coup against Xi Jinping. And good old Xi Jinping has had no idea that it's been going on. It reminded me very much, given the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of the fall of Lin Biao, about the case that was made up against Lin Biao by Mao and Kang Sheng. Since you mentioned Kang Sheng, Kang Sheng helped create the dossier to denounce Lin Biao in 1971. So I don't know what's happening with the future of the security organizations, but it's acting exactly the way it did in the past. And that is, it is both used to purge and itself is purged when it's politically convenient. I'm sorry, it's not an answer at all, but that's all I can really say.
Well, what is obvious to people that one of the least promising positions to which to be promoted in China today is to become a vice minister of public security. The number of vice ministers of public security who have been purged on various grounds, usually a mixture of corruption, disloyalty, lack of discipline, et cetera, with an occasional sexual liaison thrown in, is really impressive. Even one who was nominated and served briefly as the head of Interpol, to China's eventual great embarrassment. And of course, during the struggle for power in 2012, we had the purge of even a powerful member of the standing committee of the party who was in charge of the security apparatus.
So
here today, the continuing removal of people, I wonder what it signals.
It does remind one of the classical Chinese expression always used in regard to these matters, which is ban jun wu ban hu, to live in the company of the great of a leader of a monarch is like living with a tiger. You never know quite when it'll turn on you. It has been the nature of this kind of autocratic politics, isn't it?
Well, I wonder, what does this tell us about the speculation over the extent to which the party elite, not the masses, but the party elite is dissatisfied with Xi Jinping and wouldn't mind at all seeing his replacement? Do you have any sense of where, is he likely to withstand all that over the next 10, 20 years?
Well, as I said, I don't have the contacts I had a few years ago. I would remark, last time I was really able to hear about these things, people, well-connected people, said that Xi Jinping often changed address because he needed to sleep in different quarters because the threats against him were so constant. So that would, to him, just justify his own position. He would think that this proves that I'm really carrying out a major transformation of China. The threats, the nature of the system itself, I mean, as we know with Mao and Deng and others, they're all paranoid. And they're paranoid, as we said yesterday, as Kissinger noted, even people who are paranoid have real enemies. Of course, that Xi Jinping will have his enemies. Everybody is his enemy in many ways. Everybody within the hierarchy, those who wish to replace him, those who wish now, the moment that he is codified as being the third great leader since the founding of the party, which is what I'd imagine this document to come out on Friday will do, the moment that he is encased and entrapped in his own reputation is the moment that anybody can really feel it's open field day to get rid of him. Because once you have him, once you have the body of Xi Jinping thought, why do you need the actual physical presence of Xi Jinping? And that's always the problem. This is why Mao Zedong so famously after Lin Biao went down, a letter that Mao had supposedly written to Jiang Qing was released. In fact, we know from internal evidence that it was actually written in 1971, that was dated 1966. And Mao said, they've used the red flag to oppose the red flag. I've always been against this adulation and this personality cult, because he knew full well the minute that he was idolized, the minute he became the great leader, the great helmsman, and the great teacher, that sooner or later he could also be shunted aside. And this is exactly what his enemies in the 1960s and 70s wanted to do. So Xi Jinping has, the minute that his political ego has achieved its ambitions, which is now, and will probably be, if he survives this long, will be reaffirmed at the 20th Party Congress next year, there will be no more need for Xi Jinping. That's my personal view. I mean, he might stay around, but why bother? Why bother with the actual encumbrance of the man?
Audrey, how about another?
Our next question comes from Ronald Tiersky.
This is fascinating. Ron Tiersky, Amherst College Emeritus. I'm not a China specialist, I'm a Europeanist. I do know something about communism. A long time ago, when the French Communist Party was still very large and it still counted in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I was, so to speak, the leading American specialist on French communism. I listened to what you've been saying, and what I hear is a lot about the uniqueness of China and about the, as Jerry said, Xi Jinping, in a way, is at bottom a Stalinist. I wonder then, is to what extent, if any, is Xi Jinping a cosmopolitan? To what extent does Xi Jinping feel at home in other countries? Or is Xi Jinping basically extremely provincial? And one might say that's part of the problem with him and for him.
Thank you so much for that question. Were you a colleague of Paul Hollander's over at Amherst, I must ask?
Paul?
Hollander, the author of Political Pilgrim.
That's right, yes, sure.
It's a book that, anyway, I met him once, and it's one of my favorite books. It's again, very much relevant to the study of China today. In terms of Xi Jinping, I've met Xi Jinping in passing once at the Australian Parliament in 2015. I have read his claims relating to the books he claims to have read. I know the list of countries and the number of times he's visited those countries, and they are an incredibly impressive list. If you're talking about cosmopolitan in the communist sense, i.e. the Stalinist, Maoist sense of cosmopolitan, that is having an eye on the world and seeing it through the lens of your particular political revolution, but finding within it commonalities with historical movements and evolution, then he would regard himself, of course, as being a cosmopolitan, grounded in Chinese specificity and realities. If you're talking about a Euro-American version of what is a cosmopolitan, he's about as far away as you can get from that, as you could imagine.
Let's have another question. Audrey?
We'll take our next question from James Feinerman.
Yeah.
If you could please be sure to click the unmute now prompt. Okay, it doesn't seem that James has clicked the prompt, has been able to, so we'll go to Deanne Wilson next.
My question has already been answered.
Nope.
Okay, we'll try to go to James one more time, if you're able to unmute.
I've unmuted.
There he is.
I learned a lot from this discussion, but one of the things that entranced me about the topic was that before I was a student of Jerry's in law school, I was an undergraduate student of Mary Wright. She, of course,
great mentor
from the Tunja Restoration. And it made me think that, you know, the Tunja Restoration is not exactly a happy story with regard to the outcome of Chinese restorations. And so to the extent that they're using the same Zhongxing, nomenclature, it doesn't necessarily, create a positive historical analogy if that's what they're looking for.
No, indeed. As I said, the only time that I've seen a party leader refer to Zhongxing was Jiang Zemin in 1996. The poem was published in 1997. And it was later claimed that it meant it was a short version of the expression Zhonghua Minzu de Weida Fuxing Zhongxing, but in fact, it also overlaps with the Tunja Restoration. No, indeed, they don't see themselves as a Tunja Restoration. I do, because I think that Xi Jinping and his colleagues saw themselves coming into power in 2011 and 12 as an emergency measure to save the reforms and the revolution from collapse due to corruption, malfeasance, and the rise of a threatening new business elite that was potentially undermining the party, as well as this group of intellectuals and legal figures and activists who are pushing for constitutional reform and for the realization of the kinds of socio-political changes in terms of civil society that had been mooted from the time of the Republic of China's foundation in 1912-13. And so if you read what Xi Jinping said at that time and you look at what Wang Qishan, his close colleague, said in 2012 and 13, you sense that they had a sense of impending crisis and disaster, and that they were the last bulwark against complete collapse. And as you say, and Mary Wright's superb book on the Tunja Restoration, which I read as an undergraduate and actually inspires my thinking on this subject. No, indeed, the Tunja Restoration did help the Manchu dynasty, the Qing dynasty, revive its fortunes and helped it survive another 50 years. Now, many people speculate if Xi Jinping can do the same for the Communist Party in China today, he'll be doing very well indeed. If he can keep the whole show running until 2052, that'll be pretty magnificent. Or 2062, that'll be pretty magnificent. It will also be exactly 200 years after the beginning of the Tunja Restoration. So no, indeed, the Zhongxing usually comes after a massive dislocation, warfare, and internal strife, and is supposed to revive the fates of the dynasty. And usually there's been four major Zhongxing in Chinese history, none of them particularly successful. The Tunja Restoration, perhaps the most successful of all. Will the Xi Jinping Restoration prove the point by being a true success? I don't know. It depends, of course, on his own survival.
Next question, Audrey.
The next question comes from Nason Mahubi.
Thank you for this very, very insightful presentation and dialogue. My question connects to something, Jeremy, that you just said, and also to the other half of a point that Jerry made earlier. Jerry had said that we have a sense that maybe party elites are not particularly enthused about Xi Jinping. And we could add to that intellectuals. I think we are quite confident that many intellectuals are not very happy with Xi Jinping. But there does seem to be a consensus around the point that he does enjoy a lot of populist support among the masses. And I wonder how you would grapple, or how any of us should grapple with that point, that as best as we can tell, all of these steps that you just outlined are having the desired effect of generating quite a lot of popular support for him, to the degree that I wonder if maybe sometimes we focus too much on him and not think enough about what are these dynamics within China more broadly that he's taking advantage of or able to use to his own benefit.
Thank you so much. Indeed, I mean, I in the early 1990s, when there was this period of counter-reform following the Beijing massacre, I began speaking to many leading young Turks. These are the neo-nationalists who began to appear then. And I wrote about it at the time. I wrote a piece in 1995 about seeing, looking forward and seeing inevitably there would be a populist movement that would be inspired by nationalist goals, that would be fired by patriotism, that would be highly charged because the government was pouring billions of yuan or billion, tens of millions of dollars into patriotic education, controlling media access to information, trying to guide public opinion. And I predicted that there'd inevitably be a huge cohort of people who would support broadly based nationalist aspirations that would have a global dimension that would impact on Hong Kong and Taiwan. And it was already very evident back then. Xi Jinping has built on that coalition of belief that began, that was really reinforced back then. And he and his colleagues, the propagandists, have manipulated it to great success. They have used the anti-corruption campaign, which people behind and think is wonderful, because the people have no idea what the real levels of corruption are. They have no idea how the party actually its own disposition of funding and access to money. They have no idea about the family connections that actually have tied up tens of billions or trillions of dollars in China. So the masses are delighted by these purges of arrant officials. And indeed, why shouldn't they? It's better than what they had before. Indeed, I've always focused a lot on popular opinion and moods and the desire to, you know, I think of the latest saying that many people have heard lately in China, and this is a very popular expression. At the moment, the most popular song in China is called, "We will be traveling by high-speed rail to Taiwan in 2035. Now, it takes 10 years to build a high-speed rail. So the song, which is literally, it's the most popular song in China at the moment, last 3 days, it's therefore saying we'll conquer Taiwan by 2025. It comes along with the reframing of a very old expression from the war period, the anti-Japanese war period, which went, if every Chinese person spat at the same time, we could drown Japan. This has been recast lately as being, if everybody in China spat at the same time, we could drown Taiwan and liberate it. So yeah, what's not to like about a bit of rabid nationalism, in which you can direct all of your aggression, your self-despair, your hatred, your own frustrations at somebody else? That's what nationalism does so effectively. And yeah, good old Xi Jinping, what a great leader.
I think your mention of the corruption of the elite and the fortunes made by the important families leads me to remind people that 2 weeks from today, our next program will feature an interview with Desmond Shum, the author of a recent book that purports to give a vivid inside look at the relations between political power and economic accumulation. But now, what about adding to your Nason's good question and your very good response, the element of generational change in China? To what extent is there a different attitude of people in their 20s and 30s compared to people in their 50s and 60s that makes the youngers maybe less informed about the world and more nationalistic?
I mean, I'd love to answer. I just, as I said, I don't have any direct contact with people in their 20s now. I watch a lot of YouTube stuff and reports and so on and so forth. And it's a very diverse world. It is because China's media is a So the official media is a guided media in which you get a refraction of official policy. It's a narcissistic media, i.e. it looks in the mirror of itself and it likes the reflection it sees back at itself. However, there's a vast online world. And just putting aside all the rabid commentary and all the patriotism and all of that type of stuff, the boycotting movement, the rabid denunciation of people, all of that stuff aside, the Twitterverse, which is very familiar to all of us in our own cultures. There is a large, China does have a vast, well-educated population from all backgrounds, not just urban elites, but people in the countryside and villages and elsewhere, a large, well-educated population. And you have a publishing industry that, despite certain limitations, which are serious, nonetheless has produced an incredible amount of material in Chinese, both written by Chinese authors, reprints and so on and so forth, as well as a huge volume of translated material. You have an extraordinarily well-informed population. Many members, if they wish, can leap over the Great Firewall and get access to some information, in particular information in Chinese produced in Taiwan and elsewhere. So it's impossible to gauge. All I do know is that when I do come in touch with some younger Chinese people here in New Zealand or in Australia or elsewhere, I'm always impressed by their acuity, their insights, and their humor, and their proportionality, their sense of proportion and understanding. Does that matter? I have no idea. There is no political process. There is no media outlet. There is now also no academic outlet that gives this other China, this vibrant, complex, to use that earlier word, cosmopolitan China, an outlet that will allow it to express itself in unpermitted ways. Does it exist? Yes, it does. I can only speak from my own experience of the Cultural Revolution. I went to China when I was 20 years old in 1974. I went at the height of the anti-Confucius, anti-Lin Biao campaign. I went to school with ex-Red Guards. Our university was run by a Mao Zedong thought propaganda team general. I saw the creature up close and personal, had arguments with it, was screamed at by it, was denounced by it, like many of us were. And as soon as the Cultural Revolution, literally right after the Gang of Four was arrested, and we got news of that, I was working in a commune, of all things, picking apples for export to the Soviet Union in the Liaodong Peninsula. And as soon as the Australian shortwave radio reports reported that a number of Mao's associates had been arrested in Beijing, this is on the 8th or 9th of October, 1976. The leaders, our CADA leaders who had traveled with us from Shenyang to be in the commune, immediately, privately, and sotto voce, very silently, very quietly, would say, "I always hated Jiang Qing," or "Jiang Chunqiao was a monster, and thank God, maybe things will change now." So the second it was over, people who had been, real party hardliners began expressing their disgust and what they really felt. And then very quickly, the whole facade collapsed, and people, this flourishing of alternative China began to appear. Now, that's far more the case today. So I don't know what will happen. All I will know is that the type of repressive intellectual, cultural, and political regime pursued by Xi Jinping under this very high pressure regime is one that disguises a vast reality that's complex, nuanced, and very different from what we can appreciate on the surface.
You made a glancing reference in your opening remarks to a change in Chinese government policy toward minorities from the 1990s. And today, as in the past, Chinese government policies toward people on the periphery of China and in their territory is one of the huge controversies. Of course, Xinjiang in Tibet, and even Hong Kong, you could say, to some extent, demonstrate this. I think we would be remiss if we didn't have you say a word or two about the Han people aren't everybody in China. And how do you see that today in the light of history?
Well, tragically, I got into Chinese studies at the same time as I was studying Tibetan and Sanskrit and Buddhology when I was a teenager. So I've always been very much interested in the vibrant other parts of China that, well, occupied Tibet and occupied Xinjiang. These are, after all, Xinjiang was taken by Mao at the suggestion of Stalin. Stalin said, you know, if you don't take it, we will, and we can help you, and we can help you. I will. And Mao didn't want to go to Xinjiang, too vast, too many problems, all this ethnic stuff, and all these troubles that the Qing dynasty had had, first in conquering Xinjiang. After all, Xinjiang means the new frontier. It was the conquered territory of the Qianlong era. China had never really controlled that whole area of Xinjiang. And then there'd been rebellions, Sufi rebellions and Islamic rebellions in the 1870s and 80s, which were put down incredibly violently with mass murders carried out. So Mao was very reluctant to go there, and Stalin said, well, we'll fly the troops in. You must take it. It's important to occupy. And similarly with Tibet. Tibet had to be occupied because of the problems to do with the former sphere of influence of the British and so on and so forth, a long-term clash that China has had, as you know, with the Western trading, aggressive trading powers. Now, as you know, over the years, Chinese policy has moved back and forth. I first went to Tibet when Tibetan life was recovering strenuously in 1986-87, after Hu Yaobang had approved those changes. As you know, Hu Jintao got into power to a great extent because of his hard line in Tibet in 1988. The man who carried out the Tibetan massacre in 1988 and impressed Deng Xiaoping with his ability to crush dissent. So the crushing of non-mainstream peoples in China, let's not call them ethnic minorities, they are peoples in China, has been an issue for the communists since they came to power in 1949. And the turn under Xi Jinping is very clear. It's emphasizing certain elements of the past, and that is to basically transform the peoples, whether they're the people of the Cantonese people of Hong Kong or Cantonese speaking people of Hong Kong, the various types of people, the various groups of people, Muslims and ethnically Tibetans in Tibet, because Tibet's got a lot of Muslim people as well, or the people in Xinjiang, and that is to convert them and to create the melting pot of China, and to use the China race, the Zhonghua Minzu, this conflated, made up concept, which was, as you know, invented in the 1880s and 90s, inspired by the Japanese concept of Minzoku and inspired by the creation of the modern German national identity and the French and Italian identities. China's concept of a national identity comes from all of these, a close study of Western resurgence and Japanese resurgence in the 19th century, to create a homogenized Chinese race who all speak the right language, who all know the right China story, who all learn the right type of history with the right type of events. They can have their local variations, their little bit of local glitter and song and dance routines, but otherwise they must belong to the dominant mainstream culture as determined by the Chinese Communist Party, a culture that is not Han culture, but is an invented Chineseness that was created in the 20th century by engineers, intellectual engineers. And it's a tragedy for humanity, tragedy for China, to, you know, basically it's ecological terrorism by reducing ecological and cultural diversity to one simple pattern that itself is, highly programmed and very much cultivated phony form of Chineseness.
We only have a few minutes left, and I think we've preoccupied you with sort of China watching questions in the light of history. But tell us a little bit about your own work. Tell us about your unique accomplishments in recent 10 years or so, because I don't think enough of that is known in America, certainly. And I was surprised and impressed when I began to learn about your own publications and preoccupations.
Well, so my real interest has been since the late 1970s in the elements of Chinese culture and thought that go back in particular to the beginning of Chinese modernity, which is the beginning of the Ming Dynasty, the last 500-600 years. And those elements of Chinese artistic, literary, and calligraphic taste that relate to the pursuit of what you would call humanism. I mean, it's a term, the word humanism is used by some of the great exemplars of this approach to Chinese culture and thought in the 20th century. In particular, I think of a writer that's familiar to American readers, a guy called Lin Yutang, who was one of the, in the 1930s, was quite a popular writer who wrote for the New Yorker quite frequently. And he was a best-selling author in America in the 1930s and 40s when his book, The Importance of Living, was published in New York. I first read his work as a teenager when I was 14. My mother had a copy of The Importance of Living, which is still a wonderful book. And that gave me my first access to this whole other Chinese world. Lin Yutang established a magazine in 1920, the 20s, called The China Critic. It was an English language magazine. Later, he published a number of three other magazines, all of which were modeled on The New Yorker himself. And these were major vehicles in urban China, all the major urban centers of China, best-selling magazines that were about the creation, where they expostulated a form of a Chinese modernism that was cosmopolitan yet local, that was linked to tradition. It was also aware of the political transformation of the country taking place at the time. It's that culture that I did my PhD on. It's that culture that actually, my interest in that culture, because a lot of Lin Yutang's writing was written in semi-classical Chinese, that actually led me to read Xu Guangrun's essays in 2018, because he writes in a literary Chinese, not modern Chinese, and led me to, I've ended up as his translator. But that interest in a modern global Chinese humanism is one of the aspects of my work that I've pursued now for 40 years, and that features in a lot of my writing. And so there's that aspect of things. And then there's my interest in Qing history. We've talked about the restoration, but my main project on that, and I've done a number of books and things on the Qing era, but my main unfinished book, which is on that subject, relates to the Garden of Perfect Brightness outside Beijing, the major imperial garden, which is now called the official ruin of China. It's the place where the National Patriotic Movement was launched in 1992 by Jiang Zemin. But that garden, a vast imperial Manchu garden, is a place that I've written a lot about and I'm very interested in finishing my work on, which is a source of a lot of the type of poetic and imaginary worlds that have fed into the creation of a modern Chinese sensibility. Put it crudely, many of the aspects of what's relevant to our discussion of the Xi Jinping era is that a lot of this highly romantic revolutionism that you see in China today is linked to the late imperial era and its poetical imagination. It's called the mythopoetic complex of Chinese culture, and Xi Jinping feeds into that long tradition. And some of my work has to do with that place.
That's, I think, very helpful for people's future reference. I get a kick out of your reference to Lin Yutang's books because I think in 1942 or 3, when I was just getting to be a teenager, I found on our family coffee table a book he'd written, My Country and My People. And it was my first introduction to China.
How interesting.
Yes. And of course, he was later accused by people jealous of him of being a person playing it safe while they were fighting the revolution and the war in China. He was selling My Country and My People abroad. I thought that was unfair. Jeremy, you've given us a terrific program, a lot to chew on, very stimulating. And we very much appreciate your articulate insights. And thanks for making the time to do this. It was a good program.
Jerry, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a delight. I'm sorry if I've bored you all a bit with my ramblings. But anyway, thank you very much.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.